Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. There's nothing like a hand-picked fruit or a vegetable from our own garden. It tastes better than anything you can buy from the store. And home gardening and community gardens have blossomed all over. This edition of 411 Teen features Garden Talk with Trevor Hilton, Urban Agriculture Agent for Leon County. Trevor shares his expertise in community agriculture, urban horticulture, and citrus with 411 Teen. Trevor, I am so glad to have you. Well, I welcome you and so glad to have you share your expertise with my listening audience. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. So it's always fun being here.
Yes, it is. And I, like I said before we went on air, I always learn something. So I'm always excited to have you. Let's first talk about the County Extension Program. Just what is it? What services do you provide?
Well, the Extension Service has been around for a long time. I mean, I think we are nearly just about 200 years old.
Oh.
And a lot of folks, I would say, don't seem to know much about Extension and what we do. But we have several different programmatic activities here. We have things like family and consumer science. We have small farm programs. We have horticulture program. And of course, my program area of urban agriculture. And always you're going to have a 4-H program going on here. So there are lots and lots of different activities always happening here. And we provide service to each and everyone without any exception at all. No matter where you're from, what your background, we provide exceptional service all the time to everyone.
Now, what counties do you serve? Is it all of North Florida? Can you tell us what ones you serve?
Sometimes it would seem like that, but technically I am in Leon County. There was a time when I used to work in both Leon and Wakulla counties.
Okay.
But the way we're set up is, you know, I get requests from a lot of surrounding counties. My colleagues from time to time will call on me for maybe some expertise that I have. Even a couple of weeks ago, I was actually in Thomasville.
Oh.
Because someone there wanted someone to come out and talk about fruit trees and pruning and, you know, stuff like that. And they said that the local agent wasn't able to do that. So okay. I do sometimes cross the border and we'll do programming there.
So, I mean, it sounds like, you know, to access these services, it's just a matter of calling and requesting or email. Is there a preferred method of contact?
I prefer, you know, someone calling. Mm-hmm. And I find there are lots of things that are much easier getting over and getting into on the phone as mm-hmm. opposed to an email where we go back and forth. So I would much prefer to be called at 850-606-5240.
Okay. All right. Physically, where are you located?
The Extension office is located at 615 Paul Russell Road, right next to Zyla Street, across mm-hmm. from Jack McKinney Park.
Now, I always get questions about, I know you have a master, or you did, I don't know the status of it now, a master gardener class. Do you still have that? And if so, tell us about that master gardener class.
We still have a master gardener class. As a matter of fact, it's one of our more prominent programs that we have. You know, every year we have so many people applying to be a part of it. And of course, we only have a limited number of spaces. So, you know, they would select the folks that they need and they would do the training each month, and it goes throughout the year, after which there is a graduation, and then the master gardeners would start actually volunteering here in the office. Mm-hmm. And that's how they get their required hours of to keep their master gardener status.
So there's one class a year?
One class per year. I think they meet once per month. Mm-hmm. The courses are online.
Okay.
And so you can take these courses and, you know, at your own pace. Mm-hmm. And then when they get together as a group each month, you know, it's an opportunity to ask questions and go over anything that might not be very clear. So
what's the application process? When does it start? When do you start accepting applications?
I think they usually start accepting application somewhere around December.
Okay.
And then they would process that, you know, these by January so that they can start. And like I said, they do 1 month training, you know. So every month they would have one session, and it's spread over the entire year.
Okay. You're also known as the Citrus Whisperer. You have a vast wealth of knowledge about citrus. And those of us growing citrus are desperate to talk to you about not the past winter, but two winters past, when it was we had such a painful, hard freeze that we experienced. So let's talk about citrus for a while. Where are we now? What do we need to be doing? I know my citrus trees seem to have recovered. I mean, they are full of blossoms. But there's still some areas where they're kind of bare. A couple areas where I think it's some dead branches, but they're too high for me to even get to them. So just kind of tell us where we should be and what we should be doing with our citrus at this point.
Okay, good. Citrus is one of those crops that, you know, I highly recommend citrus because they're just so easy to grow, in my opinion. And, you know, I find it fascinating. You have a tree that's going to give you a lot of blossoms, mm-hmm, in early spring, and you have that high fragrance from,
yes,
the citrus blossom. Then later on, you're going to get fruits. And then towards the end of the year, now you're harvesting your citrus, and this tree remains evergreen throughout both, you know, winter, spring, summer, fall. They are green. So it's really a good tree to plant. They are not high maintenance. They don't require a lot of pruning, like, mm-hmm, for example, a peach or a plum, mm-hmm, or a pear that has to be pruned every year in order to maintain their productivity. Citrus are not like that. So to get back to what you asked about the after the freeze, we a lot of folks noticed that their citrus did not produce anything at all last year because of the freeze the previous winter. And the trees basically were compensating for that shock and stress that they were under. So there was no production, mm-hmm, of citrus last year. And what we're seeing now is a a major, major production for citrus this year. I think we're going to have a bumper crop of citrus. There is, you know, as you rightly say, there is just so much blossom on these trees right now. We're going to have a bumper crop this year.
Okay. As far as citrus is concerned, would you give us advice about fertilizing? Do we need to fertilize? And if so, what would be your recommended regimen?
Okay, if you have a citrus tree that's planted in an area like your garden and you have a garden bed or, you know, you have a lawn around that gets fertilized regularly, then there'll be no real reason to be fertilizing the citrus tree because it would be pulling from, you know, from those nearby garden. However, you do need to fertilize your citrus tree. And the thing is, you start in early spring, say around March, April. Now is a good time.
Okay.
And my rule of thumb is real simple. You don't have to use a specialty fertilizer. You know, you will see citrus stone fertilizer being sold. They're very good because they do have a slow release and a quick release fertilizer in it. But you could just use a regular general purpose fertilizer like a 10-10-10 or a 6-6-6. Okay. And that would do just as well. And my recommendation is for every inch in diameter of the trunk of the tree, you should give 1 pound of general purpose fertilizer, that 10-10-10-6-6-6. Mm-hmm. 1 pound for every inch in diameter. But you do not give that 1 pound all at one time.
Okay.
You break it up. Into three applications. So you would do one, say, March, April, another one somewhere May, June, and another one July, thereabout. Okay. After summer, you cease fertilizing because the tree should be, you know, loaded with fruits and all that kind of stuff right now. And you don't want to do any fertilizing in fall. So you can go all the way up to summer, but don't do fertilizing late fall going into winter.
Okay, hold your thoughts for a second. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and this is our special edition of Garden Talk with Trevor Hilton. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. What's the 411? Let me reintroduce Trevor Hilton, Leon County Extension Agent, who always joins 411 for Garden Talk. Trevor shares his experience and his knowledge on horticulture and agriculture. Trevor, we were just finishing up talking about citrus. I had one more question I wanted to pose to you as far as citrus is concerned, and that was, what about pest and disease? What kinds of things should we be concerned about or look for with our citrus trees?
I'm glad you asked. There are a number of pests and disease problems that, you know, can and do occur from time to time. But I can say this much. Most of the disease problems that we see on citrus here in North Florida, they are not of any real importance. I mean, if you're a commercial grower, I could see how some of these can affect you.
Mm-hmm.
You might have seen sometimes you have a orange or tangerine and you notice the skin of the orange is real rough and, you know, it's not as welcoming as some of the others, but those fruits probably suffer from what is called citrus scab, which is a very common disease here, but it does not affect the inside of the fruit. The fruit is still edible and still okay. Now, if you're a commercial grower, you'll probably have a hard time selling those, but for a homeowner, That doesn't matter that much. I wouldn't recommend you go out and trying to spray or do anything because the
Okay.
effort you're going to put in and the cost of doing this is not going to be worth what you get back.
Okay. All right. Well, for those who want to plant, I guess this would be the spring garden. This is what we're planning now. Summer garden. Well, I don't know what is
Yeah.
it.
It depends. Some folks refer to it as spring, some say summer because summer is when you probably will be harvesting. But yeah, for all intent and purpose, it is a spring garden.
Okay. All right. Well, if it's a spring garden, but let's start from the very beginning. What is the first thing I want to consider?
The very first thing you want to consider if you're starting a garden the spring, start with a soil test.
Okay.
And you can come to this extension office at 615 Paul Russell Road, and you can pick up a kit, and you'd have a master gardener who you can ask questions, and they'll give you guidance as to how to take that soil sample. And then that kit would have a bag and an address where you should mail this off to Gainesville at the soils lab. I think the cost for a complete test is only $10, and that gives you a reading on your pH, the nutrients that are in your soil, and it will also tell you fertilizer amounts based on the crop you're going to plant.
Okay. Now, what is the best? I guess we can have a garden here in North Florida year round. Is that correct? Because if it's not spring, then we can have a fall garden, fall winter, because it will
Yes.
go all the way up until spring. Is that kind of seems what it's like.
Yes, there are crops that you can plant. You can always have something growing in your garden. Probably the most challenging, believe it or not, is summer. Those
Yeah.
high temperature and high humidity is one of the biggest challenge that a gardener is going to have. But as far as spring, there are lots of crops that you can be growing at this time. Some crops are being carried over from winter, like some of your leafy vegetables. I still have Swiss chard and kale, lettuce, collard greens, those things, those leafy type greens are still carrying over. But as we start warming up, then they're going to start going to seed. And the term they use is bolting. They're going to start bolting. They're going to go to seed. And if you ever have a lettuce that starts seeding, it's not very palatable. It's very bitter. So then it's time to take those out. But then you can start planting your spring crops, your tomatoes, your peppers, your eggplant. And then as we go further into summer, you can start planting sweet potato, which can stay and cover your garden all the way until fall, when you would again start planting your leafy greens, your collards, your cabbage, your lettuce, and all that. And those will get carried through our short winter that we have here in North Florida. And then we start the cycle again.
Is there a preference between doing your garden at home, or even a benefit between doing it at home versus a community garden where there are lots of gardeners? I know I have my bias. I really like the community garden because I think you get to interact with other people and find out little hints. And, I mean, I started it a long time ago with Mr. Dupree and Mr. Johnny, and they all kind of took me under their wing and taught me. So I like community gardens, but I guess, I just needed to ask, does it matter whether you have community or home? Home garden. Is the What about the soil? Is there a big difference there?
I think you hit it right when you said the community part of it, where you can interact with the other folks. You can see some of the things that they are growing. And you would be surprised. You would say, "Oh, I didn't know I could grow edamame here, you know, and you know, you see certain crops growing and you realize, oh, I could try this, because you were, you know, you've always just been growing your traditional crops. And with the community garden, we have folks, you know, from all different background, and a lot of times they bring their own likes and dislikes and the crops that they love growing. And you know, you can see some different crops growing that, you know, you can learn a little bit more. You remember there were some folks, some Asian folks in the garden, and they were planting a lot of Asian vegetable. And you know, it's always a different feel. But your home garden gives you the flexibility that you can go out just about any time, you know.
Yes.
You can just, if it's almost close to getting dark, you could just run out and still do a quick look at your garden, scout around and see what's going on. So there are pros and cons to both.
What do you recommend as far as giving raised beds a try? I mean, are there benefits to raised garden beds?
I find it very, very helpful to start with raised beds.
Okay.
However, keep in mind, raised beds are going to be a little bit more expensive initially. The initial cost is higher because if you're going to use wood or if you use concrete blocks or whatever, that's an additional. And if you start bringing in soil from outside or compost to fill those beds, that's an additional cost also. Now, there are lots of benefits because, for one, the raised beds, they warm up much earlier after winter, because, you know, and you have less weed problems. And in some cases, a little less insect pest problems, you know, snails and slugs and those kind of stuff don't like crawling up those raised beds, so you might not have those kind of issues there. So, and of course, people recommend it because you don't have to bend as low to do your weeding and your harvesting when you have an in-ground garden.
Briefly explain to us how one constructs a raised bed. I mean, how high should it be? I mean, you know, how large should it be? Should you have several small ones? Do you make the beds according to the vegetables that you're planting? How does that work?
Okay. The probably the basic thing, you have a choice. If you could use concrete blocks and just build a bed, but the recommendation is don't make the beds any wider than 4 feet. Okay. 4 feet should be the max. You should be able to stand on either side of the bed and reach the middle without stepping in the bed. Because if you have to step in the bed to weed or to harvest or to do anything, then you're defeating the purpose of having a raised bed. So 4 feet, and if you're gonna use, you could use like some 2x8 or 2x10 pressure treated lumber. They would last a little longer. Or if you prefer something like cedar, which is going to be a lot more expensive, but you could use pressure treated, and you don't have to worry about what, you know, all the things they used to tell you about the chemicals leaching from the pressure treated lumber, because they're not using those toxic chemicals anymore.
Well, you anticipated my question, because I was going to ask you when you said pressure treated. I was just going to say, well, what about the chemicals in pressure treated?
Yes. All that arsenic that they used to use, that's no longer being used. And that's been quite a while now. I think probably from the, you know, late 80s, 90s, thereabouts. Okay. So they don't use that anymore. But on the flip side, those pressure treated lumber don't last as long as the old ones used to. Okay, so if you go to the store and you buy 3 10-foot length of 2x8, and you could ask them at the store to cut one in half. So now you have two 2 8 foot 10 by 8, you would have 2 8-foot sides, and then you would have 2 4-foot sides. There is actually a block, and you can get it at Lowe's, Home Depot, and I think most of your garden center. And you can just slide that piece of wood right into that. So you don't have to do no hammering, you don't nail, you don't screw, you don't do nothing at all. You just put it together. I recommend putting some cardboard in the bottom of the bed. This will keep the weeds out, and it will trap a little bit of moisture in there to start with and all that. So I like doing that. And then you just fill the bed up. And, you know, some folks will tell you, oh, don't overfill the bed or don't fill it all the way. I say fill it all the way to the top, because that soil is going to settle. Mm-hmm. Within a few months, you would be surprised. It's only going to be about halfway. So fill it all the way up. And and then you can go ahead and start planting right away. Instant garden.
Wow. Well, I know you mentioned that when we first start, the first thing we want to do is a soil test. But with the raised bed, what composes healthy soil? I mean, should we get high quality? Because we're going to have to fill it up anyway. Should we get organic matter or compost or peat moss or mushroom? I mean, there's so many different soils out there. What would you recommend? What is the best?
Okay, if you're gonna start a raised bed, especially if you know for a fact that you don't have good soil, and for the most part, we don't have the best soil around here. But you know, if you're operating in an area where you think that the soil might be suspect, like let's say you're not so sure. You know, somebody used to park a car there, mm-hmm. and there might be oil leaking in the soil and that kind of stuff, and you don't feel very comfortable with that, then yes, the raised bed is going to be your best answer, because now you're going to bring in the soil that you need. And I would say use a 50-50 mix of topsoil and mushroom compost. I find that works very well for me. And in some cases, some of the nurseries actually have a blend that they have that they will sell you for that has the mushroom compost. It might have some composted pine bark and topsoil. Those work very well also. And you'll find that, you know, I was telling you about a bed that's 8 feet long by 4 feet wide by 8 inches high. That particular size bed would take about 1 cubic yard, which is about 1 scoop.
Okay.
You know, that would take about 1 cubic yard. So if you have a pickup truck, you could always carry that much, you know, at one time. And yeah, I would suggest when you're doing that, you buy in bulk versus trying to buy bags and bags. It's going to be more expensive trying to go bags.
What vegetables don't grow well in North Florida? As we are selecting our vegetables, what do we need to skip, so to speak?
I am trying to think right now. You know, I don't go out and recommend, you know, like things like asparagus.
Okay.
Because it's not to say it don't grow here, but it takes a long time.
Okay.
You're not going to plant asparagus and start harvesting, you know, like right away. No, that's not going to happen. So, yeah, that can be a little bit challenging. I'm trying to think. Most of your leafy vegetables will do well here. I wouldn't necessarily recommend things like iceberg lettuce.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not good for you.
You know, it doesn't seem to do as well for us. But the leafy type lettuce works very well, very well for us.
Okay. Well, on the flip side then, let's say somebody's just starting out. What would you suggest for a high yield, low maintenance, new gardener?
Okay, good. Glad you asked that one. Maybe I might start by making some suggestions of some of the things not to do.
Okay.
So if you have a limited space and you're just starting out, you're going to want to get the best bang for your buck, right? So I wouldn't recommend you go planting corn.
Okay.
Corn, you're going to have to plant a lot of corn for it to work. And the other thing is that corn is relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, come July, 4th of July, you can get corn for maybe about 30 cents, 40 cents,
mm-hmm.
you know. So using up your limited space to plant corn probably is not a good idea. Okay. If you want a crop that's going to give you a lot for a limited space, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, you're going to get a lot. I mean, you could safely get 30, 40 pounds from one plant.
Really?
Yes. So these are the ones that you know, if you're saying, well, I want the best bang for my buck, that's where you're going to go. But probably the most important thing is plant what you like.
Okay.
Because if you don't like it, you probably won't even bother to harvest it.
Right.
So plant what you really like.
Okay, that's good advice, because I would think it would be awful to be planting something and you're kind of indifferent about it at all.
I have had that experience. I had a garden that...
Let me ask you to hold your thoughts. Just hold it and you can come back and share with us what you were going to say. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but our conversation will continue shortly.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am just always thrilled to have Trevor Hilton do Garden Talk with us. Trevor, I had to interrupt you, but continue your thoughts.
Well, I was mentioning that I had a school that I work with, and we had this garden. We started late, so our choice of planting material was very limited. All mm-hmm. we could find was banana peppers, and we planted mm-hmm. banana peppers all over the garden. And those things produced like I've never seen before. But guess what? Those kids did not have no interest at all in banana peppers.
I'm sure.
So yes, plant what you like.
Yeah, that's important. And in deciding what to plant, do I use seeds or starter plants? I mean, are there benefits to one or the other? And what do you suggest?
The thing, if you're planting a small garden, you know, 4 feet by 8 feet mm-hmm. garden, and you want to plant some tomatoes, you want to plant some peppers, some eggplants, and, you know, that kind of stuff, I wouldn't suggest you go buying seeds and starting seeds. You could buy seedlings from the store a lot cheaper than you could probably produce them.
Mm. Okay.
If there's a particular variety that you're trying to get that the garden center don't carry, then yes, by all means do that. You know, plant, start from seed. But you have to remember, you're going to have to start those seeds early. So a lot of the seeds that are the seedlings that you see in the stores, they are over six weeks old. They're close to 2 months old. So you have to start, if you're planning to plant spring vegetable tomatoes, you would have to start in January. So you would have to be able to keep them inside You would have to be able to get light on them. So you see all that extra effort that you have to put in. So if you don't have those, then I would say buy you some seedlings. They are relatively inexpensive. You can buy a 6-pack of tomato for maybe $4. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, so.
You mentioned tomatoes. Now, tomatoes, we can grow year round. Are there vegetables? What vegetables it seems like tomatoes we can grow year round. I may be incorrect. You correct me. What vegetables can we grow year round here in North Florida?
I don't think we're going to have many that we're going to be able to do year round.
Okay.
The tomatoes, as you mentioned, those, the big challenge is if it's too hot or too cold.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a warm season crop, but if it gets too hot, they shut down. They don't produce anymore. If the nighttime temperature stays, say, above, say, 75, 80 degrees, you know, you're not going to get tomato to set any fruit. So there are some heat-set tomatoes that would grow well in high temperature. And the commercial growers who do 2 crops of tomato per year, they have that special variety that they can plant in August so that they can be reaping come November, thereabout. But for the most part, your tomatoes that you're going to get around here, they're only going to work in spring, and they're not going to do well. Collard greens is one of those that I would come close to growing year round. But the big reason that most folks don't plant collard greens in a warm month is not that they won't do well, is because the insect pressure is so high.
Mm.
They will chew that thing up when it gets warm.
Okay. Well, that leads right into asking about pest. Since you started, you mentioned about the insects. Talk about pests. I mean, they're beneficial and non-beneficial pests. I mean, I know like some spiders and wasps and praying mantis. So will you talk about the pests that we may encounter in our garden?
There are lots of pests, insects that are beneficial. You know, I mean, most people know the ones, the ladybugs, those kind of stuff. And, you know, we all know about bees that pollinate and all that. But there are other insects that actually prey on some of those bad insects. So we have some of those, like the assassin bug. The important thing is to be able to recognize these because some of these don't look like they are good insects. You know, if you don't know them, your first option is to think that they're bad insects. So if you don't know, your best bet is to ask. This is where we come in. This is when you can ask us. Okay. You can take a picture. And the thing about it too, there are lots of apps now that you can use on your phone to help you to recognize insects.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you could tell which one is good, which one is bad. My basic suggestion would be if you have any kind of insect infestation, you know, try and control early. Don't wait until it gets out of hand, because most of the time it's too late. Here in North Florida, one of our biggest bane is stink bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wait until those stink bugs become adults, you're never, ever going to control them.
Okay.
And I also suggest that if you use insecticide, use the one that is least toxic. Mm-hmm. And then if you're not getting enough or good enough control, then you go up to something stronger. But don't just go and grab, you know, something real. Sometimes it might be as simple as just mixing a few drops of dish soap in a spray bottle, and you could spray your aphids that are on your tomato plants. You don't have to go out and use any real toxic chemicals. And then you could start looking at some of the organic stuff like your neem oil, you know, that they have very low impact, you know, on the environment. So use those first.
Diseases with your plants, as opposed to infestations. What are the diseases we need to be aware of? Are there any early disease symptoms that we need to look for? Can you talk about that?
A lot of diseases, when it comes to disease, most of it, you're going to have to do almost preventative. Mm-hmm. Because when you start seeing the symptoms of the disease, it's probably too late. You're not going to be able to control the disease at that stage. So okay. We know that as we go into the warmer months and we have more rainfall, so we have high humidity, lots of moisture in the air, and warm temperature, this is the perfect time for most of these diseases to proliferate. You know, things like blights, mm-hmm. and mildew, those kind of stuff. They love that kind of weather. So the thing you're going to have to do is try not to get them in their comfort zone. So don't water your plants late in the evening so that they get wet going to bed. And, when you water your plants, try as much as possible not to put water on the leaves, get the water to the roots. So All that can help. And if you have to, try and control some fungal diseases, there are some, that same neem oil is very good. Neem is both an insecticide, a fungicide, and I think it's also a miticide. So it's very good to have. And, things like copper is, very, very low impact on the environment. And they are actually organically recommended. They're organic. So diseases have to be controlled. And as soon as you start seeing signs, you can't wait for them to get out of control.
So now with irrigation, I have a question. Those sprinklers that sprinkle the whole plant, they really aren't the ideal way?
They are not the ideal. If I were to go ahead and say they are the worst.
Okay.
But they do have a place, because if you have a large enough garden and you putting in drip irrigation, again, is a high expense. Those overhead irrigation would work well for grassy type stuff. If you're planting sugarcane, it probably would be good, but they are not the best for vegetable crops. I would suggest, if you don't go to a drip type system, at least do a micro irrigation where the water is being sprayed at a lower level and not necessarily on the leaf. So these micro irrigation emitters, they are probably only about 12 inches. So they would be spraying the water much lower, and it would not be as bad as spraying the water on the leaves.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask the question that I know you get a lot of, and I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What about weeds? What can we do about weeds?
believe it or not, that's probably one of the questions we get the hardest, because you have a lot of folks who come in. I can make you a recommendation for an organic fungicide. I can make you a recommendation for an organic insecticide. Mm-hmm. There are not many organic choices when it comes to weeds. You're going to hear people say, there are some vinegars out there that they're not very effective. I can tell you that much. They're not. And, you think about it, That vinegar can actually change the pH of your soil real fast also. So there's no shortcut when it comes to weeds. You're gonna have to get out there with a hoe. You're gonna have to get down and you're gonna have to pull those weeds. That's the only way you're gonna get it done. So if you're not someone who wants to use a herbicide, there's no other way. You're gonna have to, use the tools and your hands and get those weeds out.
I knew you were going to say
Actually, there is another one that has become in a little bit more popular. There are some folks who are using a torch and just burn the weeds.
Oh, really?
Yes, so you walk around with this little torch with a liquid propane. And you just you, so you target the weeds, so you're just hitting the weeds, nothing else.
Okay, so it must be really small then, because if you just hit the
Yes,
weeds.
yes. And it has a long one. I think I've seen them in Lowe's and Home
Okay.
Depot. I don't remember where else, but yeah, that's becoming very popular.
Okay, all right. In these last few minutes, what about compost and mulch? How efficient are they? Do you recommend them?
If you garden, I would highly recommend that you start a compost pile,
Okay.
because you are gonna generate waste. And the best
Okay.
thing to do with the waste, because I mean, at the end of the year, at the end of your crop, your tomatoes, your peppers, all these things, you're gonna have that waste. The best thing to do is to compost these, and because it if you compost correctly, you're returning a lot of nutrients to your soil.
So what's the correct way? Tell us what
Okay.
how we do it.
Let me start by saying that for a compost pile to work, it must be at least 3 cubic feet. So
Okay.
it has to be at least 3 feet long, 3 feet wide, 3 feet high, at the very least. If it's smaller than that, it's not going to work very well. It's going to dry out too fast.
Okay.
So I always tell folks, don't make it too complicated. Get you say 4 pallets and just tie them together.
Okay.
And all your garden waste and your kitchen scraps, toss them in there. Don't put any meats or any milk or any oily stuff, no mayonnaise or those kind of stuff.
Now,
And put all your kitchen scraps in there. If you mow your grass, I would say catch it with a bag and take all that grass clipping, put it in your compost pile also. That has a lot of nitrogen in it that can be very, very useful to your garden. And you do that. You will hear all these things people say about, oh, you have to turn your compost and it's hard work, it's backbreaking. If you don't turn your compost, it will decompose, but it will take much longer. And some of your weed seeds, this is why we don't suggest putting seeded weeds in your compost, because those would not decompose very well. But if
Okay.
you like me, I'm a lazy gardener, so I don't turn my compost. I put everything in one big pile, and maybe once every 2 years, I pull it apart and I take out the stuff that is decomposed, and the other stuff that is not decomposed, I put it in another pile and start another one and put all the undecomposed stuff in there. And that's how I do it.
Okay. Do you recommend, I've seen compost containers. Do you recommend using those? Because I'm thinking about what if you're using a community garden and, how do you compost there?
The compost containers, there were some that were being sold or given away. I don't remember. There were these little black conical looking container. They're not ideal because
Okay.
they're not big enough. I don't think they are 3 cubic feet to start with. And I've gone to a lot of home visits and I see some of these in the backyard with some coffee filters and a lot of ants and other stuff running around in there because people just get to the point where they forget about it. Now, one of the big flaws of that particular compost is that it's covered. So you don't get the benefit of rainwater going into it. And you have to remember that the compost is, they are living creatures. They are microorganisms that are actually in there that are breaking down these plant material.
Okay.
And in order for any living organism to survive, they must have water.
All right. Well, that's it, because it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Trevor Hilton, thank you so much. Trevor is the county extension agent, and he's shared his expertise in gardening. To my listening audience, thank you for your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio at WFSU.org.